to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tasha Chaparis. Joining me on the show this week is Collin County reporter Julie Fancher.
Hey, Tasha.
We'll talk today about how a rash of attacks in Oaklawn parallel the fear in the gay community in 2005 after seven men were killed. At the time, many feared there might be a serial killer targeting gay men. Garland Police Detective Gary Sweet joins us today.
Hello.
To discuss one of those cases, which remains unsolved. Garland, Dallas, and Arlington police joined together in 2005 to issue a public plea for information on the deaths. Three of the killings remain unsolved. Later on the show, we'll be talking to Raphael McDonald.
Hello.
He's the communications and advocacy manager for the Resource Center, the LGBTQ community center in North Texas. And Lee Doherty.
Hello.
Owner of Alexander's, a bar on Cedar Springs. Let's get started. Julie, can you explain a little bit about what was happening in 2005?
So what we found was happening in 2005 is that from about 2000 to 2005, there was a string of about seven gay men that were murdered over the period in different parts of the area. There was a case in Garland, a case in Arlington, and a couple in Dallas. And the Dallas Voice did some stories on how there may be a connection or how police were investigating a possible connection between those cases because they were all unsolved and there were some similarities, I think, between some of them. Just, you know, they were all gay men. What we found talking to detectives is that there didn't really appear to be any signs of forced entry into the home. Wasn't really sure if anything was taken. So there were some similarities, but there were also some differences. The ways in which some of the men were killed were different. And so, you know, from that point, there was, you know, I think a lot of fear in the community. And that's kind of what we saw in some of the articles that we found from 2005. There were a lot of, you know, press conferences with members of the community and police, kind of just, you know, issuing a plea for any information. And then that was kind of, I think, what the last that we heard of that until we checked back in for our story, the series Unsolved, and we found that three of the cases have since been solved, and three are unsolved, and one, I guess, was determined not to be a homicide.
Right. That one case ended up being possibly a little unclear on the cause of death, and it didn't appear that there was foul play. But they're looking back at some of the coverage of the time and some of the stories we saw, we noticed that there was a lot of concern about whether there was maybe one or possibly two killers specifically targeting gay men. So Detective Gary Sweet, you're with us today, and you investigated one of those cases. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, that was December of 2000. It was Keith Calloway. Just a brief rundown. He was last seen downtown Dallas at a club. He was with some friends. They left. He told them he was going to stay a little bit longer. He was discovered the following day when he didn't show up for work. His job called his parents, and they went to his apartment to check on him and found him deceased. And his car was missing. It was a couple of days later we found it downtown on another street, not very far from, it was in walking distance from the club that he was at.
So at that time, did you talk much initially to other departments?
At that particular time, no. Mm-hmm. No more than normal. We did our usual investigation. We had no solid suspects at the time. He did have a boyfriend that some people called that people thought was, I think after his death, they started thinking he wasn't right, and we never could locate him. We spent a lot of time trying to identify who he was, and even as far as having a composite done of him through people that had seen him, but we still to this day don't know who he was.
So can you tell us a little bit about, I know when you and I talked, you mentioned some outstanding evidence that you found. Can you talk a little bit about that?
This was a, for lack of a better way of putting it, a very brutal murder. There was a pretty good fight took place. There was a lot of blood. We found some blood in a bathroom of the house where it appears somebody may have went to clean up. It was away from the actual crime scene itself, where it looked like most of the fight took place. So we kind of thought it was interesting. We took samples of that, obviously, and had it DNA analysis done. And it did come back to someone not Keith. It was, so we felt that was our suspect's blood. When we recovered the car, we had the ashtray was full of cigarettes. And we had the cigarette butts analyzed for DNA. And we did get the same DNA on the cigarette butts that we got from the blood at the house. So we feel like this is our suspect. It's been in CODIS, which is the system kind of that analyzes the DNA that's been entered. And it's not hit for, what is this, 15 years now.
So can you speak a little bit to the time when Dallas detectives, you from Garland, and then Arlington detectives got together and kind of issued a public plea for more information, and if there was really a belief that there was possibly one or maybe two people that was behind all of these attacks?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact year that all this... The FBI has a program, it's called VICAP, that we enter in we enter in the details of the case, and they will run it in a computer system, and it will kick out every murder that has certain matching points. And we, you know, they'll be from all over the country. The first real interest came is when it hit a Dallas case that was very similar. So I made contact with that detective that was working that case, and we met several times and compared, and he also brought up a few other cases that they had that he felt were similar that didn't necessarily show up, but we never really could link them together completely. But it was at that time we thought this could be a serial killer. There were some unusual things done at this scene that pretty distinctive. That and it, surprisingly, it did kick out some similar things that were the same. But that particular case, and I don't remember the name of the victim. I think I do, but I don't want to say it because I may be
right.
wrong.
Right.
But ended up, I think that was one of them that they cleared, and it was not the same guy as ours.
Right. It seemed that a lot of the kind of similarities among the men were they often went out in Dallas. So that's how an Arlington case kind of seemed to be connected possibly as well. In the Garland case as well, he had been in Dallas the night before his body was found. One of the other things, like Julie said earlier, is that in all of them, there was not a sign of forced entry, meaning that they knew their killer. Whoever it was, they welcomed him or her, probably him, and into their homes. And also, it was never really clear if anything was taken from the homes. So it wasn't clear if it was possibly a motive of robbery or burglary. So, Raphael, can you talk a little bit? I mean, you remember some of these, and you remembered some of the concern. Can you say a little bit about what was happening?
Yeah, during this time, 2000 to 2005, I worked for one of the television stations here in town as an assignments editor. And I remember us particularly covering, because I worked a lot out of our Fort Worth office, covering the case in Arlington. And I remember, they said also, the detective said, I want to say 2005 thereabouts, that there was this big news conference and then the follow-up story in The Voice. And there was, you know, a lot of concern in the community. And you've got to remember, you know, 10 years ago, we didn't have smartphones. We were still dealing with the flip phones. So you weren't able to have the apps or the contacts, or maybe not being able to have that interconnectedness that we have now. So the fact that there might be, or even the suggestion that there might be someone out there who was specifically targeting a segment of the community, meeting them at an establishment, and then, you know, targeting them for murder was just kind of unnerving. It was kind of unnerving. And I remember, because, you know, we all covered it. And I was surprised, you know, when the article came out that, wow, those cases are still unsolved. Yeah, I remember that one. Yeah, I remember that one. Wow. And they haven't solved them.
Right. We have three that aren't. One, obviously, Keith Calloway, that we're talking to Detective Sweet about. Also, Lawrence Wheat, who was found beaten to death in his apartment in the Cedars. He was actually a member of the Planning Commission. And that one still remains basically a stumper for detectives. And then also James Stephen Watts, who was found killed in his North Oak Cliff home after he didn't pick up his brother from the airport. And again, those similarities. There was no sign of forced entry. Wasn't really sure if anything was taken or if something was. It was never found again. And the only connection was that some of those men met people often when they went out and possibly went home with them. And so that seems like that was some of the fear, is you don't know who you're meeting when you're out.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a fear that's still today, for that matter. I mean, I think, you know, you have to exercise prudence and caution.
Detective Sweet, when we spoke, you told me a lot about your dealings with Keith Calloway's family and kind of how personal this case is for you. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that and what you think it will take to close this case. I know we're going on in December 16 years. So
I'll be honest with you. I thought this was a case that would be solved by now because of the physical evidence that we have. It don't get much better than what we have right now, but still nothing. Keith Calloway, part of the process on a murder investigation is to start with your victim and work your way out, who he knew and who he hung around with, and most of the time you're going to find who this is. We started with coworkers, close friends, the people he were with that night and interviewed. If you go at it hard enough, most people don't want to talk bad about the deceased. They don't want to say bad things about anyone that's been murdered, but that's what we're looking for, is what bad things what reason would someone have to kill him? I couldn't find any, and I pride myself on finding it. I couldn't find anyone to say anything bad about this guy. His family, they were just awesome people. Nice. There were reasons for, if you want to look at hate crimes, there were reasons. He was African American. He was gay. You know, there's reasons right there that people would, he could be targeted for a hate crime. Everyone that knew this guy, and I'd be careful saying this, but the guys next door would fit the type of people that wouldn't like him, maybe, and they loved him. I mean, he would come over and watch football games. Everyone loved this guy. So I couldn't find anyone that would want to kill him because of anything. He would borrow money occasionally from people at work, but he always paid it back. No one had a bad thing to say about this guy. I do think... and obviously, if you listen to it and kind of put it together, that he picked someone up at a club because he drove them home because they had to take his car to get back to where he picked them up at. I mean, that was my thought at the time, and that's what put the fear that, okay, this is someone at a club. We obviously went to every club we could go to and passed out pictures, and he liked to go to the clubs, and that was a concern, that there may be somebody out there that is going to these clubs looking for people to assault. Just still no luck at the clubs. Great cooperation. Obviously the owners of the clubs wanted to catch this guy too, and nothing's ever come up good.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I mean, people want to know that they can go about living their lives, and if they want to go out to a club and meet someone, they want to be able to feel safe doing that. So I can see a lot of that fear. So let's talk now a little bit more about what's happening more recently. So Raphael and Lee, I know in December there were a rash of robberies and attacks in the Oak Lawn neighborhood, including the pretty brutal beating of a bartender. At that time, Dallas police assigned a special task force to patrol the area. There were community meetings to explain what was going on. So can you speak a little bit to what was happening then, how you feel like things are going now? Is there still a lot of fear? Have there been any other cases that have been concerning?
It's deeply concerning to the community, is because, as previously mentioned, this seems to be almost a cycle that there are people out there that are targeting this community. And it's somewhat disheartening as well, is through the almost score of attacks we've had since September, that there have been no arrests. And, these cases don't seem to be progressing into that direction of an arrest. I know Dallas Police Department, and they have their special division that's working on this, continue to work on it. But whenever you have that unsolved feeling, again, it kind of shakes the community a little bit, that there's, you know, possibly someone out there, a group of people out there that are possibly in the clubs, possibly watching people walk out of the clubs and targeting those people for whatever reason.
Mm. I think a lot of it is also, it's a wearying feeling. I mean, we've been... This has been happening that we, you know, and it depends on, you know, what, how, who, and when, and where you, you know, we start counting this, I guess, as of September, the attack after Pride. But there's been at least one or two others that happened, you know, earlier in the summer. So it's exactly how many are we dealing with? Is it 15? Is it 16? Is it 17? Is it more than that? Are there cases that are not being reported? We're fairly certain that there are cases that are not being reported and were not reported. So, you know, kind of getting that number is like nailing Jell-O on the wall. It's difficult at best. And so I think there's a lot of wearying. It's like, you know, when is this going to get solved? When are we going to go back to normal, whatever normal was in terms of stuff? And the answer is, you know, probably never in terms of that normal, because we have to be vigilant. This is a big city. And part of being in a big city is that there are going to be people out there who are going to look to take advantage of folks.
Right. And this might sound kind of like a dumb question, but there are probably a lot of people listening who aren't as familiar with Oaklawn as we are. Other parts of Texas might not know what Oaklawn is at all. So can you all speak a little bit to what exactly the Oaklawn neighborhood is and why it does feel like these attacks might be specific to the gay community?
Oaklawn is kind of the heart of LGBT Dallas. Traditionally, and I say going back to probably the 1970s, it is probably the neighborhood where many LGBT people have lived. Some of the clubs have started there or have moved from other parts of town to that area. There are restaurants there. There are affirming churches. The organization that I belong to, Resource Center, that's where we got our start. That's where we are based right now. And that it is kind of, you know, it's kind of considered, you know, our neighborhood, much as, for example, maybe you have listeners in the Houston area, Montrose is kind mm-hmm. of a similar neighborhood, or Halsted Street in Chicago, or Greenwich Village in New York City, or West Hollywood in the Los Angeles area. It's kind of considered to be a neighborhood that has been traditionally the home of the LGBT community for a number of years.
So kind of a safe haven.
There. You want to go there. You know that you're going to find businesses that, you know, are open and affirming to LGBT people, whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a club, whether it's a shop where you can buy cards or gifts or something like that. It's a neighborhood that we kind of in the LGBT community think of as our own, our home away from home, if you will.
I attended some of the meetings that some of the Dallas police and the council members had kind of, I think, September, October-ish. And I know back then, businesses and the community members were asking, we need better lighting, and having walked through there, there's some poor lighting. It's, you know, and so, you know, Lee being the owner of a business over there, and Raphael too, have you guys seen any of that happen? Has there been any improvements, or what's been going on?
Very initially, when the attack started to happen, a campaign was launched pretty much via social media called Lights, Camera, Action. And it called to a three-step approach for businesses and organizations and anyone involved in that area, in the Oaklawn area, to provide better lighting, get better security cameras, get exterior cameras up, and remain vigilant. We fully believe that, you know, complacency led us to have these attacks. You know, we became accustomed to crime in that area. We didn't do anything about it, and then it spilled on the street. Cedar Springs itself, which is the heart of Oaklawn there. We did see quite a few businesses. As a business owner myself, you have to look back at your priorities and, you know, realize that safety comes over profits. And not all business owners think that. And it was kind of disheartening in some sense, but a lot of owners and a lot of organizations did step up, invested a tremendous amount in the infrastructure of the security camera system. We did a Light Up Oaklawn march where we identified lights that are out, reported them to Encore, had them fixed, worked with large corporations down there that had large parking lots, got all of their exterior lights fixed. So there has been a tremendous amount of effort put into that and a tremendous amount of success. We have more cameras, a lot of bars invested in exterior cameras, not really focusing inside. Let's go ahead and point them outside and cover our parking lots, cover our streets. And Dallas Police Department as well, I believe, just finished or have installed most of the 10 cameras at major intersections there as part of this movement as well.
Right. There was a temporary camera that went up right there at Cedar Springs and Throckmorton, basically the central heart of the LGBT neighborhood. They put in a temporary camera there, I think, November-ish, and then a couple weeks later, they got some other loaner cameras from the manufacturer and put them up at a couple of other places. But within the last, week or so, perhaps, it seems that most of the cameras are up. I noticed there was one, for example, right there at Oaklawn and Cedar Springs at the Monument, which is where we traditionally have had various rallies over the years for stuff. And now there's actually a camera right there at that intersection. So, those cameras are now in, and, hopefully they can serve as a deterrent or as possibly being able to gather evidence in a particular case. These cameras, they talked about putting these cameras in, I want to say, August or so during some of the budget talks this past council year. And so there was always going to be some cameras going in there. They had identified the neighborhood as needing to have some cameras just to reduce the overall crime rate. It took these attacks happening to move that up the priority list. And, that's just kind of the way that is.
Yeah, unfortunately, sometimes to get attention on these areas, there has to be something bad that happens and can be pretty reactionary. So the final question, I guess, is more for you, Lee, as a bar owner and a gathering place. How have you seen your business affected? What have people been saying? Were people afraid for a little bit, and now they're starting to come back out again? What's been the reaction for you?
The reaction was, it's disheartening. This community is very tight, knows pretty much everyone in it, and we knew these people. And, I had two staff members that were attacked. One was a little bit before Pride, and that's when I kind of got geared up. And, the most important thing was, again, to come out and talk to people and, address their concerns. There has not been a downturn of business, and I think it was very important for businesses and organizations down there to step forward and let people know that we're actively pursuing solutions to make sure this doesn't happen again. I added armed private security on the weekends. I worked with my neighboring properties to secure their properties as well, and a lot of businesses did that. The community itself is very strong. I mean, the community has been through so much. Whether it was the string of murders 10 years ago, the AIDS crisis in the 80s, and we've gone all the way to, the marriage equality decision last year. This is a fighting community. This is not a community that backs down, that gets scared, that stays home. This is a community that will continue to go out and might possibly go out even more in force just to show that when, hate is thrown towards this community, we just simply react with love. And I think that is the common goal and the solution in all of this is, there will always be haters. There will always be people targeting this community. But if we, consistently, push back with love and acceptance, maybe one day we'll reach that point where we don't have to deal with this issue anymore.
I think that before we, kind of wrap up, Detective Sweet and Raphael, for people who are listening, let's say if anyone has any information about, the Keith Calloway case, how should they contact you?
To contact the Garland Police Department. And there's a Crime Stoppers number, and I don't know it.
We can add that to our website.
I don't know what it is. It's something tips, but if they would call that number, and please, if you know something about it, call.
And Raphael, if anyone in the community needs to, reach out to you, how can they?
Yeah, certainly. Reach out through a resource center. MyResourceCenter.org is our website. One thing I would encourage folks, we touched on the fact that there are some of these crimes that we know are unreported. It is vital. It is important, underline, asterisk, whatever kind of bold print you can put that in, that people contact the police. I understand that in the LGBT community, there has been a fear and a distrust of law enforcement. And that's, you know, that certainly over time that, you know, you go back, you know, many years, you know, that is certainly the case. But it is vitally important if we are to catch the people who are responsible for this, that these crimes get reported. And I cannot emphasize that enough. And reported in a timely manner. You know, one of the incidents that was happened, I think it was December of last year, a guy was jumped outside of one of the bars. You know, he didn't report it for 2 days until after his coworker said what happened, and he told them, and they said, "Hey, you need to call the police." And you know, it would be much more helpful if that had happened, you know, much quicker to when the actual incident happened. So that is something that, you know, I would urge. I mean, we don't want to see any more people become survivors down there from this. I think ultimately that is the bottom line. That's why everyone is being told to remain vigilant. That's why the businesses, why the community groups like Resource Center are out there urging people to, you know, park in well-lit areas, you know, carry a whistle with you, make sure you're aware of your surroundings, those kind of stuff. But, you know, God forbid, should that happen to somebody, pick up the phone, call 911. Pick up the phone, call 911.
The police can't investigate what they don't know is happening.
Absolutely.
So, yes, absolutely echo that. Well, thank you again so much, everyone. Want to thank Gary Sweet, Raphael McDonald, Lee Darty, and, of course, my co-host, Julie Fancher. Join us again next week. Our show comes out every Thursday. We are on iTunes, so be sure to subscribe to our channel. Tweet us at Texas Crime Cast. And remember to find more on all of our stories today and continuing coverage on DallasNews.com. Our producer today is Tommy Noel. I am Tasha Chaparis. And now here is Hashing It Out with Mike Hashimoto. Take it away, Mike.
It's not just any politician who can turn a gospel radio station into a crime scene. Dwayne Carraway has put himself all over the front page of the local newspaper this week. Normally, that would be a good thing for a guy trying to unseat an elected institution like John Wiley Price. Less so in Carraway's case. The former Dallas City Council member had to know a challenge to the iconic Price would be uphill, even with Price under federal indictment on corruption charges. Still, Carraway had the name ID to rate a puncher's chance in the race for the District 3 seat on the Dallas County Commissioner's Court. That effectively fizzled out Monday when Carraway allowed Price to bait him into losing his cool during a debate at the Heaven 97 studios. Carraway has taken his shots at Price during this campaign, and Price has fired back. That's politics. Two supposed leaders of Dallas's black community having to be held back from physical violence is something else. That something is, at best, an embarrassment. Or is having to call 911 on these guys something different? Carraway's second front page notice for blowing two deadlines on campaign finance reports seems almost quaint by comparison. Voters in this Democratic primary will speak Tuesday. Any undecided is melted away when Carraway undermines his best argument, all because he let a gutter fighter get under his skin.